This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Our panel of writers is here, ready and eager to discuss the important events of the week. Here in the studio, we have Robert Morley.
Good to be here. Today, we'll talk about a superbug that doctors are very, very worried about. It's spreading across the U.S., and we'll talk a little bit about it and what can be done about it.
We also have Anthony Chibatterway.
Good day. Today, we'll talk about Venezuela and the trouble that's brewing there. It appears that the military is now being forced to pick between the president and the people.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here. In the first half, we're going to be talking about the dangers of a second Pearl Harbor moment for America. And then in the second half, we'll get into nuclear subs in the Pacific.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Brad McDonald. Hello.
Good afternoon. Today, I'm going to talk about an imminent crisis in Germany. It's an economic crisis, but it's going to quickly turn into a political and social crisis for Germany, and it will have implications for the rest of Europe and the rest of the world.
All right, we have a lot of great news to cover today. We'll get right into our first story about the militarization of space. We think of wars being fought over territory and resources here on Earth, but space has actually become an important battleground because of our reliance on technology, satellite-guided navigation, satellite-based communication, and so on. The United States is currently a lot more reliant on satellite-based technologies than any other nation on Earth, and this enables it to do some pretty incredible things, but it also makes the U.S. vulnerable to attack. If another nation can go after that space infrastructure, it can wreak havoc on the U.S. So to talk about this and some news that has come out this past week about this, we're going to turn to Andrew.
Yeah, well, military analysts are actually saying that America's next Pearl Harbor moment could come in outer space. And so just give a little bit of a history lesson for, well, many of you probably already know, the original Pearl Harbor is when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor Naval Base in Hawaii and forced America into World War II. The reason behind that is there was this standoff over the South China Sea between America and Japan. They knew once they started attacking nations, the American military would try to stop them. So they tried to issue a preemptive strike on the American Navy, knock out the American Navy. America can't do anything to hinder their regional ambitions. Lots changed in the half century or more than half century since then. And now military analysts are really starting to point out that in a future conflict between America and China over the South China Sea, or maybe even between America and Russia over Ukraine, they said if a new Pearl Harbor comes, it'll likely happen not on this Earth, but in outer space. As you'd mentioned before, America's very reliant on space technology, but other nations are trying to catch up, especially Russia and China. And actually, even just last month, President Xi Jinping of China paid a pretty high-profile visit to one of his Air Force bases in Beijing, really telling them that they needed to step it up in terms of space technology in case of any future conflicts. And over the past several years, China's launched about 142 new satellites just to gather intelligence and navigation and other communications. Russia's made similar moves. We have an article in our Trumpet Weekly just really putting how both those nations, China and Russia, are developing for the past couple decades what they call ASATs, which are anti-satellite weapons designed to knock satellites out of the air. And that really seems what the military analysts are focusing on. As they said, America's got a pretty decisive lead in the space race since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's very unlikely that in recent years any other nation would be actually able to catch up to have a similar space power in America. But in regards to a conflict like the South China Sea or Ukraine, they don't really have to. They don't actually have to use space power to defeat America. They just have to keep us from using ours so they can use conventional warfare on the Earth. That's why these analysts are using the Pearl Harbor moment. It's not that China's are going to use satellites to invade the United States or something like that. It said if they can send one of these ASATs, knock out a couple of our key satellites, scramble the communications, it'll throw them back enough that they can use their more conventional Navy and Army techniques to get whatever regional ambitions Russia may have in Eastern Europe or China may have in the South China Sea, and America won't be able to get there in time.
Yeah, a lot to talk about here. First of all, just how do you mentioned Pearl Harbor, and there's a specific territory, there's a specific property that needs to be defended, but how do you defend against anti-satellite technology? You've got these satellites that are spinning all over the place. How does the U.S. or any other nation, for that matter, that's using satellite technology in that way, defend itself?
Right, and I mean, there are moves in the Pentagon to try to spend some more money on, that's generally the American philosophy at military things, is throw money at it and to try to see what defenses you could get. You'd have to use, like, it would come down, especially if you're getting to working about ASATs, it would be almost be similar technology like you'd use for nuclear missiles, where you'd need some sort of other system that could detect when one of these missiles is launched and try to hit that missile before it hits your satellite. So it is tricky because, I mean, even if you've got a decisive lead and much more power than another nation, you're still always vulnerable, like Pearl Harbor was, there's a sneak attack. Obviously, America's Navy was much more powerful than Japan's Navy in World War II, but the thought was, at least that was the Japanese strategy, is that while they were doing drills out at sea, they'd bomb the base while they weren't looking. And again, using like a space Pearl Harbor, we do have missiles that are designed to try to keep those satellites protected, but within a sneak attack, it's hard to be looking everywhere at once.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of satellites to keep track of.
Right. Yeah. In our the newest edition of The Trumpet, which we just finished last week, we have an article by Richard Palmer called Not Much Bang for the Buck, I believe is the title. And he's talking about just how many elements of America's military, which we think of as so dominant, how much it's really handicapped itself through misspending, that a lot of the money that's going into the program, that it's being used in ways that won't give American advantage, and draws attention to that prophecy about our strength being spent in vain. Here's really another means by which America's military superiority can be neutralized. You were talking about, say, these other nations that are up against this highly sophisticated, technologically dependent American military in theaters like Ukraine or wherever they may be, and how suddenly America becomes a very average, very conventional force when those elements of technology are eliminated from the equation.
Right. It's surprising what you can do with not very much. I think Putin, he's kind of an old-fashioned type of guy, old KGB man. But I know in Russia, and I mean, Russia's military is very technologically advanced too, of course. But I know that's one story I heard a couple years ago where he started bringing out like the old typewriters like he used to use back in his time as a young man. And his theory was that he said, well, America's very technologically savvy with like NSA spying and all that. He said, so for my highest profile communications, I want to go back to the James Bond style typewriters and manila envelopes because you can't hack those.
Right. We talked last week about that NATO exercise where the Germans and the Poles outperformed the Americans in tank warfare, just because we've basically positioned ourselves to fight more sophisticated, more insurgent type warfare, and this is just something that we haven't practiced a whole lot of. And what happens when, say, our planes or whatever element of our military become disabled because of a downed satellite? Then suddenly we're forced to resort to aspects of warfare that we're just not used to doing. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. We appreciate that. Obviously, the news cycle in the United States right now is completely swamped with political coverage. But believe it or not, there are important elections and political moves happening in other places in the world. We have a couple of stories here next about recent moves elsewhere. We're going to start with Israel. The Jewish state has a new political coalition and a new defense minister, and a man that a lot of people aren't particularly happy about. For this story, we're going to turn to Anthony.
Yes, Israel's new defense minister, his name is Avigdor Lieberman. He's not entirely new in Israeli politics. He has worked with Benjamin Netanyahu before in his first administration back in the 90s. And even recently, he has served as Israel's foreign minister. That's between 2009 and 2015. So he has been in politics for some time. However, the big news has been that just this week, he was named the defense minister. And that's a pretty powerful, pretty significant position for Avigdor Lieberman, especially when you consider how right-wing he is, how ultra-nationalistic he is. He is the head of the party that's called Yisrael Beitenu, which means Israel, our home. So you can get a sense of the kind of individual that he is. Now, there's been a lot of intrigue going on to get him into power. It has been because Benjamin Netanyahu, he only had a one-seat majority in the Knesset, and he needed a little more than that to strengthen the government, to make it more stable, to help him with all the decisions, the big decisions that have to be made in the Middle East, especially in the times that we're living in. So he was trying to bolster his coalition government, so he was reaching out to all these other parties, and he successfully signed a deal with Lieberman. And Lieberman's demand was that he wants that defense minister position. Now, a lot of people are not very happy about that because they're looking into his track record. He has made a lot of bold statements about how he despises the peace process. He has talked about beheading Israeli Arabs who are not loyal to Israel. He has talked about bombing a dam in Egypt, the Aswan Dam. He has talked about assassinating politicians in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. He has been openly critical about Israel's war with Hamas, the recent war in the summer of 2014 in Gaza. He said that Israel wasn't decisive enough in that war. So he's very right wing and he's gotten a lot of people worried.
I do think it's important to point out though that like a man like this who you know, obviously the press is going to have a heyday with comments like that, but we are talking about a nation that has had to fight and scrap just to survive. And a lot of those views that a man like Lieberman would hold, I think you have to admire his fortitude in the face of the kinds of threats that Israel has had. I mean, there would be a whole lot of press outlets that would take anything that this man says as evidence of extremism that's beyond the pale, and the idea that he would be a defense minister would be horrifying to them. But it's not that difficult to see why Benjamin Netanyahu would be open to the idea.
Certainly, and I think the most important thing to take from this development is that, or the symbolism in that move. I mean, we might even just push aside our opinions about it and just focus on what people, how people perceive this development, how people look at it. Mm-hmm. Just give an example of even the United States, the State Department. State Department spokesman just said that, well, this raises a lot of legitimate questions about the direction that Israel is taking. So even just from that, you can see that there's going to be a lot more tension between Israel and the United States. And of course, on the Palestinian side, you have a lot of these Palestinians just saying, you know what, we probably just need to be more violent. We just need to take on arms because this is not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to negotiate anything. Well, the Palestinians have made it difficult themselves, but they're going to use that as an excuse to pursue a militant approach to
It's an excellent point.
Securing legitimacy there.
So Israel already is quite isolated in a number of ways, and as much as somebody like this can stand up and say, well, we need to be a lot tougher against the enemies of Israel, the fact is you're talking about a cursed nation. You can talk tough, but there is a certain reality here and an inevitability about how Israel is isolated, and the enemies of Israel are going to use this as fodder for stepping up their activity for sure.
And you can also see how, it ties a lot with the Bible prophecies about Jerusalem and how it's not going to be a simple solution to the problem in the Middle East. The Bible talks about a violent takeover of East Jerusalem. And when we have this kind of right-wing leadership in Israel, you can see that they are not going to be given away East Jerusalem without a fight. So this just verifies those prophecies in the Bible about that violent takeover in the Middle East. And it does point to really great news in the future about what's going to happen after that. But in the meantime, we can see how this prophecy is being fulfilled in greater detail.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to shift now over to Austria. This move to the right isn't only happening in Israel. It's a little different what's happening in Austria, but there were recent elections there. We talked about this last week before the election. Now the results are in. And to tell us about this, we're going to go to our man in the UK today, Brad McDonald.
Thanks for having me. Just one, I might just pick up on one point that Anthony was talking about there. I agree with you that I don't think we can view Lieberman as one of these racist bigots that we tend to think of right-wing politicians in other parts of the world. Something else to consider, too, the world can beat up on Israel for swinging to the right, and that's the way they would put this development. Well, it's largely the international community's fault. If I was Israel and if I was fighting the world, not just Hamas and Iran and radical Islam, but the international community, including its main historic ally, America, well, then this is a natural course of action to institute leaders who are going to defend the country. So the world or the international community has their part to play in this.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Austria. It's not every week that little old Austria is the center of attention here in Europe, but this week it was. On Monday evening, a number of politicians and journalists across Europe really breathed a big sigh of relief when they learned that Alexander Van der Bellen, the Greens member, won the presidential election in Austria, in Vienna. The election was strongly contested by Norbert Hofer. He's the leader of the Freedom Party, which is Austria's right-wing party. He actually came within 0.3% of winning Austria's presidential election. He was leading in the polls leading up to the election. A lot of people thought he had it in the bag. At the end of the day, he lost the presidential election by just a few votes. But as a lot of people have noted, the election was not a loss for Hofer, for the Freedom Party, or for right-wing parties across Europe. I'll just read a couple of quotes. This quote comes from the Gateston Institute. Hofer can claim victory even in defeat. By winning half the ballots cast, Hofer has exposed Austria's gaping political divide on immigration and relations with the European Union. And that's really a big story. Half of Austria's population are in favor of this far-right political party. Half of Austria's population, 50% of Austrians, favor anti-immigrant policies, have a distinct anti-EU sentiment. One point to note from Hofer's campaign manager. He said, "This is a huge achievement. Hofer managed to convince half of the population in defiance of the system." And the point that many have made about what about Hofer's victory in Austria, and it is a victory for the far-right party, is that this is happening all across Europe. Far-right political parties in France, in the Netherlands, in Germany, in Sweden, in Slovakia, they're all experiencing similar success.
Yeah, that's an excellent point that you made about Israel. When you see what's happening there, it really is in response to increasing threats in other parts of the world. And this is precisely why we're seeing this move in several European nations. We've tracked this trend for months here on the Trumpet Hour, and just how much popular support you're getting for this kind of nationalistic, we need to defend our own, we need to look after our own interests in the face of major threats globally. It's because it's happening in Austria, because it's happening in the heart of Europe, and because of its prior history that we really pay particular attention to this trend specifically.
Right. There is a lot of history. Obviously, Adolf Hitler lived in Vienna. Even today, if you get up into the Alps and if you talk to older Austrians, there is a latent anti-Semitism. Hofer was a big advocate of what is called pan-Germanism, and which means, you know, he believes and his supporters believe that Austria really should be a part of a larger German-speaking empire. Hmm. Obviously, that has some history to it that is concerning. James Dellingpole is a journalist here in the UK. He wrote an article in Breitbart, and he just he made a couple of interesting points here. He said that the native working class in Austria, as in the US and across much of Europe, are angry about immigration and feel unrepresented by the liberal political elite. This cannot end happily. And he's talking about the rise of right-wing political parties across Europe. This cannot end happily. Indeed, it was under similar circumstances in the 1930s that another Austrian-born citizen, considerably more far-right than Norbert Hofer, began his rise to power. And that's the thing about the rise of the far-right. I think a lot of us, or a lot of people who tend to be more conservative or traditional, they'll identify with what supporters of the far right believe, but it's the direction, or it's the elements within the far right that are more extremist that's really concerning. They're the ones that we have to watch. It's when you have 50% of a population that is disgruntled and unhappy, there's a lot of potential there for someone like Adolf Hitler or someone who's radical to come in and just tap into that resentment and bitterness and frustration and really wreak a lot of havoc.
Well, thanks for that story, Mr. McDonald. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll have one more story before the break. We're going to talk about something totally different. We like to think of this being a time of science and medicine eliminating many of the diseases that have plagued humankind through its history. But in some ways, science and medicine have a part to play in creating new diseases thanks to the creation of antibiotics, and sometimes viruses respond by becoming more virulent. We hear about super bugs and other problems like this. And to tell us about the latest news in this arena, we are going to turn now to Robert.
Yeah, there's apparently a super bug that has been identified in the United States now, and the Washington Post ran an article talking about this. Actually, it was carried by several outlets. But for the first time ever, a person in the United States was found to be infected with a bacterial strain that is resistant to the most powerful antibiotics that we have. The best medicine we have for defeating these infectious diseases and related to bacteria are unable to touch this bug. And this is causing a lot of health officials, members from the CDC, Disease Control Center, to be very worried about what this could mean. Some officials are even saying that if this strain of bacteria spreads its antibiotic resistance to others, we could be heading back to a time that is reminiscent of the pre-penicillin age, the age where people would die from the flu or the common cold and things like that that we just take for granted today. You know, you get a little bit ill, you head off to the doctor, he sends you, he gives you a couple pills to swallow, and a couple days later, you're feeling better, you're great again. Well, the world didn't used to work like that prior to 1928 when, penicillin was first discovered. So this is something that a lot of people are worried about. The authors of this discovery, they work for the Defense Department, and they said it, quote, heralds the emergence of a truly pan-drug-resistant bacteria. And they're talking about this drug's ability to resist colostin, which is basically known as a last resort bacteria. These superbugs that resist this type of antibiotic kill up to 50% of the people that get infected with them.
So where do we get this bug from? Where does it come from?
The researchers that were looking at this think that they've tracked it down to pigs and people eating pigs, consuming pork, and the agricultural practices that are really just widespread around the world now. A lot of these experts are blaming our modern agricultural practices, like the industrial farming of animals. And as you know, the way it works today, you try to jam as many animals onto a piece of land as possible, into a barn as possible, onto the feedlots. But that naturally just causes disease to spread among animals when you're doing that kind of thing. So what farmers, what these feedlots do, they just feed these animals a cocktail of antibiotics, just a soup of antibiotics in with their feed every day, just to make sure that if there is any disease, it catches it and it stops animals from spreading it to other animals. Well, what researchers are finding now is this is actually causing the rise of these superbugs, because what's happening is these antibiotics are just killing off all the good along with the bad in these animals. It just nukes their bacterial populations that are living in them, except if they have a bacteria in them that's resistant to the antibiotics. And what this is doing is this is selecting for those drug-resistant bacteria that naturally occur out there, that are naturally kept in check by all the good bacteria that keep them suppressed. And when we go and we nuke the natural bacteria that are in these animals, which is what we're doing every day, it allows these superbugs to start reproducing, to start multiplying, and to take over animals. And what we're finding is the medical industry is constantly having to find more powerful and different antibiotics to knock these superbugs down. And now we've actually got to the point where they're finding bacteria like this one that is resistant to the most powerful bacteria we have. And this is what's scaring people. Now, there's a little bit of good news with this. The good news is this specific strain of E. coli, bacteria that was resistant to this particular antibiotic, this particular E. coli strain can be controlled by a lesser type of antibiotic out there. So even though it's resistant to the most powerful, there's a less powerful one that can work on it. But what concerns researchers is that it's going to transfer its resistance to other bacteria and other E. coli bacteria. And this is a phenomenon that occurs all the time. It's well known and it's practically guaranteed to happen. So this is something that I think we're going to see a lot more of because of our agricultural practice, because we treat the way we treat diseases in America. And this is the type of thing we're going to see hitting headlines more and more often, I think, as we go forward.
Very, very interesting to see what happens when we focus on effects rather than causes, and we feel like we understand the nature of a problem and we're addressing a specific effect that we're dealing with at that level, rather than asking ourselves, well, why is this happening in the first place? That whole, what you said about just the way that we're killing off these good bacteria and allowing these bad bacteria, these malicious bacteria to flourish, it's really remarkable, because eventually you have to pay the price for broken law. You know, eventually you're going to be dealing with those the effects that come from those causes. You can only circumvent them for so long, but you're going to have to pay up eventually. We see that happening economically. We see that happening with our health. You mentioned our food production practices, all of those things. The price comes due at some point. Well, we appreciate that, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about an invisible crisis about to strike Germany, China's nuclear submarines, a catch-22 that Venezuela's army is finding itself in, and the fact that young adults are less likely to live with a spouse or a romantic partner than they are to live with mom and dad. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
A really interesting analysis piece from the always interesting George Friedman this past week. We have excerpts of it in this week's edition of the Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report that contains all of these stories that we've been talking about, that we talk about each week on the Week in Review Trumpet Hour. For a summary of this article, we're going to go back to Britain and we'll hear from Brad McDonald.
It is an interesting article. It's original too, which I appreciated. I haven't heard this angle on Germany, or I haven't read about this angle on Germany anywhere else. But the logic is fairly simple. Germany is an export-driven economy. 45% of Germany's gross domestic product comes from exports. And the point George Friedman made is that the world's economies are shrinking, or in the very least, they're not growing. So what that means is that Germany, over the next few months and years, is going to face more and more difficulty selling products. Now, when your economy, 45% of your economy, relies on sending products outside of the borders, that's going to bring major problems. The point he makes is that as Germany has trouble exporting goods, manufacturing is going to go down. As BMW and Siemens and these other big German companies, they're not producing as many goods. They're not going to need now as many employees. So they'll turn around and they'll start laying off employees because they're not able to sell their goods. As employees are laid off, unemployment goes up. The word unemployment, or the issue of unemployment in Germany, it always terrifies a lot of people. High unemployment in the 1930s propelled Hitler's National Socialist Party together. He became very popular advocating he was going to fix Germany's unemployment problem. So unemployment has historically been a serious issue for Germans. And then if one other thing to consider is if unemployment goes up and more Germans are not in the workforce, and we have all of these migrants entering Germany, trying to enter the workforce and competing with Germans for jobs, then this is only going to add a lot more competition and tension between unemployed Germans and the migrants. Friedman explains how Germany so far has been able to stave off the crisis. It's doing that by reducing the cost of its goods. So it's not charging as much for the goods it manufactures, and America and China and some of these other countries continue to purchase German-made goods. But he's making the point that China is contracting. America is contracting. The economies or the markets are shrinking, and it's inevitable that Germany is going to have trouble soon selling its goods.
So does he have anything to say about where this might lead within Germany beyond, say, what happens from that point?
Right. He doesn't. The article really lacks that angle. He does say that it's going to be a revolutionary crisis for Germany, but he doesn't talk about the details of that revolutionary crisis.
There's only so much you can see. There's only so many steps ahead that you can anticipate, but there are so many pressures on Germany right now, economically, socially. You mentioned the immigration crisis, politically. Andrew, you had a comment.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's another interesting thing that could watch for is the return of ideology. I'm actually tracking a very similar trend to this right now in China. They're also export-driven economy. They're facing the same problem Germany is right now. And so what their leader's doing is he's actually commissioned like a whole new council of academics to invent a new version of Marxism, because he's realizing that he knew back before China was an economic superpower, like under Chairman Mao, they relied on Marxist ideology to unify the nation. haven't had to so much the past 30 years because they could just rely on the fact that they're making a lot of money to rule the nation. If that's going to change, he needs to bring back the Marxist ideology to try to keep people together. You could see that. I haven't heard as much from leaders in Germany, but if they're facing a similar crisis to China is, where they've got more like Catholic ideology would be something that have deep historical roots over there. They may need to lean more on that crutch to keep people united if they don't have the economic prosperity to do that for them.
Right. And they'll need an outlet. They need someone to blame. And as you suggested, or as you mentioned, there's already a lot of animosity and frustration toward migrants. Germany in the past few years, because its economy has done so well, has brought in, I think, more than 1 million migrants from Turkey alone to work. More than 1 million, I think it's more like 1 million or 1.5 million Turks are in the German workforce. Because for the past 10, 15, 20 years, the German economy has been doing so well. Now, if the German economy is not doing well, then there may not be jobs for either those people or native Germans. But things are going to get a lot more dire for the regular German on the street. His life is about to be affected in a very tangible way.
Well, you'd have to think that German leaders, astute German leaders, would be looking at this and really seeing a potential crisis on their hands. And some of the most chilling prophecies in the Bible are in the latter chapters of the book of Revelation, where it's describing the economic power that's going to be amassed by a European empire helmed by Germany, and the fact that it really does get its act together economically, that it becomes a massive superpower economically, really dominating the world economically. So you know that there are solutions to this, short-term solutions, and really some pretty chilling and terrifying solutions that are going to be employed pretty soon.
Right. One angle I think we really need to watch is, and again, there are parallels to the 1930s. There was a massive global financial crisis in 1928-29. German exports dwindled. What did Hitler do? Well, he came in and he told the big companies, okay, you're not making goods that you can sell to the rest of the world. Start devoting your resources to building tanks and weapons and even airplanes. You could see that happening now. Germany, there's so much room for Germany to expand its military. The world is practically, the Western world is begging for Germany to do more militarily. And in terms of hardware, there's a lot it can do to catch up with America and Russia and China. So, okay, maybe BMW has trouble selling X3s to America. Well, what if the government turns around and says, well, you know, why don't you make some tanks, or why don't you make some weapons, or why don't you, you know, keep people employed and let's grow our military, or let's build more infrastructure for Germany, kind of like America is doing, and China and a lot of these other governments around the world. They're borrowing money and then investing it in their own infrastructure.
That is a perfect segue into our next segment. We thank you for that story, Mr. McDonald. We are going to go back to China now. This morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Stephen Fleury was talking about the spread of nuclear weapons in light of President Obama's visit to Hiroshima, apologizing on behalf of the U.S. for dropping an atom bomb there. But the dreams of nuclear nonproliferation are fading. China is getting ready to send nuclear subs into the Pacific. To tell us about this, Andrew Miller.
Right, and this is a good continuation off what Mr. Stephen Fleury's comment on his Trumpet Daily Radio Show, of course, but it's also a direct continuation on kind of what I was talking about in the first half of the show with space technology, because, see, America had put a missile system in South Korea, allegedly to help counter North Korea, but with the capability to hit missiles, high-altitude missiles out of the sky, like some of those anti-satellite missiles I was talking about earlier. So America is kind of trying to counter some of China's space race stuff with some of these high-altitude missiles. So now China this week has used that as their excuse to say, well, if America's going to have these high-altitude missiles in South Korea, we need to start putting submarines armed with nuclear weapons out at sea with the capability to counter that. Now, China's had nuclear weapons for some time. They've had submarines for some time. They've had missiles for some time. But to try to keep tensions down, they've always kept them in separate places. The submarines at sea, the missiles someplace else, and the warheads someplace else. And it's only like the high leadership of the Communist Party that would be able to make a decision to put all those things together at the last minute. Now they're saying that, okay, well, we need to actually put the nuclear warhead on the missile and put the missile on the submarine and then send it under the control of a captain out to sea, so that last minute, I mean, Xi Jinping can just give him a ring if something, tensions between America or some other nation comes up where he thinks that that missile's needed and it's already put together, assembled, painted, and ready to go.
More evidence of the disparity between America's assessments of the threats facing the world and those of the leaders of other nations, and particularly China and some of these nations where it's more authoritarian leaders that are willing to step up and do the things that the world is supposedly shying away from in this enlightened age. We thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to go now to South America. We've seen some trouble in Venezuela this past week. And for that story, we're going to go to Anthony.
The president slash dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has just created this nightmare from his socialist rule. The economy is free-falling, prices are skyrocketing, inflation is forecast to exceed 1,642% next year, and there's a lot of crime in Venezuela, shortages of basic commodities, rampant corruption, and because of all these problems, the Venezuelans have been hitting the street protesting against Nicolas Maduro. They want him to step down. And about 2 weeks ago, Maduro declared a 60-day state of emergency. But you know why exactly he did that, or the reason he gave for it? Because the United States is about to invade Venezuela. That was his reason. It's almost comical. But here you have a nation, the fate of a nation that's at stake here. And this is what makes it so serious. So in the face of this invasion, Venezuela, they had recently they had military exercises. They called them the biggest military exercise in Venezuelan history because of this supposed threat from the United States. But of course, it's fairly obvious to everyone that the threat here is not the United States. This is just a distraction for Maduro. He realizes that his rule is at stake. People want him to step down, and they want that they might use a lot more force to accomplish that, and he now needs a strong army to support him. But then you have the opposition party that is now calling on the military to pick sides, essentially. Either you stand for the people or you continue on siding with Maduro, and either way, there's going to be a lot of problems in Venezuela. The main leader of the opposition there in Venezuela, his name is Henrique Capriles. On May 18th, he said this. He was talking to the military and he said, "The hour of truth is coming to decide whether you are with the Constitution or you are with Maduro." And observers realize that Capriles would never have made such a statement if there wasn't a section of the military that was willing to stand up for the Constitution and oppose this slide toward authoritarianism by Maduro. So you're seeing this potential clash coming in Venezuela, and it doesn't look very good. Now, I think what we can foresee happening in the future is that Capriles, who has a lot of clout in Venezuela. He has opposed Maduro before. He has challenged him in elections before. And he has a lot of support from the Vatican. Soon after losing elections in 2003, he visited the Vatican and he had a private audience with Pope Francis, and he was essentially pleading with the Pope to intervene politically in Venezuela. So this seems like just a ripe opportunity for the Vatican, for Venezuela, for Capriles, for the opposition in Venezuela to try to create changes in Venezuela. And you can see how the Vatican might want to jump onto that opportunity, because Latin America has the most Roman Catholics. You can see how they want to have a strong influence there.
Yeah, definitely something that we've been watching for many years, the Vatican gaining more influence in Latin America and really extending Europe's reach across the Atlantic. Well, thank you for that, Anthony. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to conclude this segment with a story about Mom's Basement.
Yes, American culture has reached a new millstone. A new milestone. Pew Research Center. It came out with some findings this week. They reported that for the first time in modern history, young adults are more likely to live in their parents' home than they are with a spouse or partner. This is a trend that we've actually been following for a while. This isn't something that just has suddenly happened. But they reported that when you look at young adults, those who are 18 to 34 years old, so a pretty wide span there, if you look at them and you look at the percentage of them living with their parents, that number has now hit 32.1%. So almost a third of young people between 18 and 34 are living with their parents back in the basement or back in the old bed that they grew up in back in the day. So this is something that has been intensifying, but it is not new. And Pew went ahead and they identified some of the differences based on race and based on education, and they found that 36% of blacks and Hispanics as young adults are living with their parents, and that compares to about 30% of whites. They also found that it broke down based on education. People that were less educated were more likely to live at home. And also one other finding that they found that I thought was very interesting, they found that young men in particular were more likely to be living at home with their parents than with a romantic partner.
Did the Pew data have any indication as to the causes of this trend?
They did. They identified several. I think they missed probably a couple that I would include on the list. But for example, they blamed the worsening job market. They took a look at the 2008 economic crisis, and they said this is a trend that has picked up since then. It was already in progress, but it did speed up then. And I think there's some validity to that. I think that economic crisis, when people were losing their jobs, it forced people to head back to their families for support. I think there's some validity to that. They also said that it was due to, quote, a dramatic drop in the share of young people who want to start a family. And I think that's interesting, too. I think that's just very telling of our society today. I think if you look at marriage today, it isn't valued the way it has been in the past in terms of social norms relating to sex and sex outside of marriage. I mean, that's much more common, obviously, today than it was a generation ago. So the marriage isn't needed in that sense for many young people. One thing that they didn't mention in that, a couple of things. One thing they didn't mention is student debt. And I think that's a big part of it, too. People simply can't afford to go out and start families the way they could until later on in life. And I think that's playing part of a role. And then also, mentioned that there's a lot more pressures on young women to have a career today. And that is also leading to less young women starting families and putting that off until later in life, or maybe even get to the point where they're not even able to have that later in life.
There is hope, though. I mean, Senator Bernie Sanders himself was in his 40s before he earned his first paycheck, and now he's almost came close to being the president of the United States. So
let's not count things around. Yeah, well, it is very troubling. I think I think what Pew said about people just losing interest in starting families, that really was the driving factor that caused people to take those steps into adulthood for generations. That was what drove a young man to get a career, to buy a house, to be a provider for his family. Once those roles broke down, we're left in this wasteland where it's kind of every man for himself, and you don't really necessarily have a lot of incentive. There's a lot of things pressuring you away from making those steps that really do and help you to grow up and to take responsibility for yourself and for others. So, definitely a trend that we shouldn't be too surprised to see getting worse and worse. Well, thanks for that, Robert. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on The Week in Review are in that report. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Anthony.
The leader of the terrorist group Hezbollah said that he is expecting a hot political and military summer and fall. He said that he predicts that none of the conflicts in the Middle East will be resolved before the American presidential election.
All right, we'll go next to Andrew.
Well, Taiwan's days as an independent country could be numbered. They just elected a new president who, in her inauguration speech, refused to reference the one country, two systems philosophy that Taiwan and Beijing have been operating under for the past several years, indicating that she could take a much more antagonistic stance towards mainland China at a time when mainland China is gaining a lot of military power in that region.
All right, we'll go now to Rob.
Well, federal immigration officials will soon open a new detention facility in Dallas, and this is a very special detention facility. It's for transgender detainees that are coming through from Mexico and other nations in Latin America. Advocates say that transgender immigrants need to be treated differently, just because they have hormone issues and they might be going through transitions, and the guards need to treat them. Then we need specially trained guards to deal with those issues that they could be facing.
That's very heartwarming. We'll go now to Brad.
There is a cadre of EU officials secretly working on developing plans for a European army. Apparently, the meetings in which these plans are being developed are so secretive that EU officials are not even allowed to bring in their cell phones or computers. They can only take handwritten notes. And the plan, apparently, is that this policy for a European army will be revealed on June 24th, the day after Britons go to the polls to vote as to whether they should be in the EU or not.
Very, very canny. All right, now back over to Anthony.
After 2 years of strained relations, Iran has resumed its financial support of the Islamic Jihad terrorist group. Now, the leaders of this terrorist group, they were praising Iran for its support and actually singled out Iran as the only country that's helping them. It said that Iran is the only country that supports the Palestinian Intifada because it sponsors them and it pays for martyrs in among the Palestinians.
All right, back to Andrew.
Again with Iran, the supreme leader of Iran met with the prime minister of India in Tehran this Monday, and they signed a $500 million deal to develop a strategic port in Iran for India's use. It's just the latest indication that Iran is really trying to integrate its economy into China, a Chinese-Indian-Russian-led anti-dollar alliance in that region of the world.
All right, back over to Robert.
Well, there were some pretty big protests outside the McDonald's Corporation headquarters in Chicago this week. They were demanding higher wages. They want that $15 per hour wage. Interestingly, McDonald's CEO or ex-CEO came out and said, these people are shooting themselves in the foot. Today you can buy a $35,000 robotic arm that flips burgers better and more efficiently than any hamburger flipper out there. And these things are coming, and a wage push to 15 is going to lead to mass layoffs that people are not expecting.
All right. Well, we will cut it off there. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Anthony Chibotterway, Andrew Miller, Robert Morley, and Brad McDonald.
You're welcome.
Good to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Epictetus. When you are offended at any man's fault, turn to yourself and study your own failings. Then you will forget your anger. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.